Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Danielle Riendeau.
Hi, hello.
Austin Walker.
Hey.
Natalie Watson.
Hello, hi.
And we're also joined by our colleague, Noisy, Colin Joyce.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Good to have you.
I have some important news.
No, it's fine.
Okay. Sorry. To be clear, we were all kind of wrapped by a piece of new news. A number of pieces of new news. Some of which we will not talk about here.
This isn't libelous, which, right? Or slanderous. I guess it's a podcast.
Well, I guess this isn't new news. It's just a new fact.
I'm going to start just by reading from the second paragraph of Trader Joe's Wikipedia page.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, that means it's safe and true.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. That's what I've heard.
Yeah. As a journalist.
Trader Joe's was founded by Joe Colombe in 1967. Starting in 1979, it was owned by German entrepreneur Theo Albrecht, a former soldier for the Nazi German Army, until his death in 2010 when ownership passed to his heirs. Trader Joe's, owned by a Nazi soldier until 2010.
That's a long time.
I was shopping there before. I know I was.
Trader Joe's has great exclusives.
No, we draw the line at shopping at Nazi stores.
Wait, hold on. We actually need to know, like, okay, was this guy, like, in the SS? Or was he, like, a guy conscripted in 1944 to go, like, I don't know, just stand in a trench while Russian tanks roll over it? Like, that's worth asking.
I don't know how deep we want to go into this, but I did do a lot of Googling about this yesterday when I discovered it.
Again, a journalist.
Yeah.
Yes.
Google, where all the news lives. Unfortunately.
Sad.
So I was Googling because Aldi came up. You know Aldi, the supermarket chain. And I was like, aren't Trader Joe's and Aldi owned by the same company? And the answer is sort of. They were owned by a pair of brothers, both of whom fought for Nazi Germany.
What?
They split. Aldi split into two companies in the 1960s when there was a dispute over selling cigarettes at Aldi.
Aldi said no or said yes?
Some Aldis do and some don't. So they split into Aldi Nord and Aldi Süd at that point. The brothers had a falling out.
More brothers?
Over cigarettes. Okay. Good on the Nazism.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean,
shaky
shared
on
history.
Cigarettes. Yeah.
Wow.
So that, at least that's what I understand to be true.
Nationalism, not Nazism. That's not how we say that. Anyway, continue. Correcting myself.
In the 70s, one of the brothers bought Trader Joe's, and that brother is not the one that operates Aldi in the States. So one brother operated Trader Joe's in the States, and the other one operated all the Aldi stores in the States. Very strange.
But they were both soldiers.
Yeah. One of them, from what I can gather. Okay. So they also were very private people. There's not a lot of like reporting about them.
I would be too.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. You know, I'm just going to add one thing and we can move on to waypoints. This is from Yelp. Joseph M. There's a thread here. Trader Joe's owned by a Nazi. And Joseph M. says, it's true. Trader Joe's is really owned by the 20th richest person in the world, a former soldier in the Nazi army, Theo Albrecht. He and his brother brought the Monrovia-based retailer in 1977, way before its major expansion in the U.S. And then Mr. Yelpitude responds, actually, what's worse are the employees. They are worse than the overly exuberant Starbucks staffers.
No!
Wow.
This Yelper's account has been closed.
Okay, hold on, though.
Mr. Like this Yelpitude.
All right. I got a well, actually, this. The dude was a teenager when the war starts in 39, and he was conscripted into the Wehrmacht. He didn't volunteer. He wasn't some, like, there's nothing here that says, like, he was some Hitlerjugend sack of shit. Like,
but we don't know. That's the thing. He died without explaining it.
Well, I mean, if you're drafted, you probably weren't. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing, is it makes me
He wasn't a pilot, you're saying? He wasn't someone who was, like, kissing the ring?
Right. Like, we don't, like, there's enough here in his bio and his obituaries about the guy to suggest that, like, I don't know what the guy actually got up to. I don't know what his beliefs were before the war, but he was drafted, and he went to serve in the Africa Corps and surrendered there, apparently. So, you know.
What I'm hearing is Trader Joe did nothing wrong.
That is also what I'm hearing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. An honorable right. store.
Sorry for this. We had to get
serving,
this out of our systems. Otherwise, it would just be gnawing.
T-R-A-I-T.
Traitor.
Traitor
Joe. Right. Wow.
Yo, fuck Joe.
Wow. Okay. It's all out there now. We all know how we feel about Traitor Joe.
Okay.
We wish he would have been a traitor is the actual thing. Yeah. That would have been because the supermarket started by someone who betrayed the Nazis.
That's cool.
Way easier to shop there.
Yeah. Dope. Catch me there anytime.
I'm eating those cookies.
Yeah. I'm eating those Jo-O's.
And Jo-Jo's.
Anytime.
Oh, what is this podcast really about, Rob? What did you say at the top? Culture?
Yeah, nerding culture. Out? Things that we found inspiring. I guess we could say Trader Joe's was provoking for
yeah.
sure. But yeah, so I guess we'll just dive into this right from the start. So this week, Natalie, for your waypoint, you've been listening to Lil Peep's Come Over When You're Sober Part 2.
I have.
As many listeners will know, this is a posthumous album from the artist put together from material he'd been working on at the time of his passing. Natalie, before we dig into this album, can you set the stage a little bit? I think we've all gotten pretty cynical, justly so, by the way, about like posthumous albums popping up after an artist's passing and the way that is often bound up with like exploitation of an artist and their popularity. But what should we make of Come Over When You're Sober? Who was Lil Peep? And what are things to bear in mind as we consider this work?
Yeah, I just want to say first that I invited Colin over here because Colin wrote this excellent article for Noisy titled Little Peep's First Posthumous Album is Haunted by What Could Have Been, which summarized it spoke to so many of the things that I was working through while I was like listening to that album. So I thank you greatly for this piece of writing.
It was definitely good for me to work through writing it. There's so much to think about.
Yeah. I guess I kind of wanted to start with I'll first explain who Lil Peep was, and then I'll go into like what draws you to writing about him and Austin to you listening to him, and then Danielle, maybe like what Danielle and Rob, what kind of questions or what thoughts, since you two were like not previously exposed to Lil Peep as much, what kind of things came across for you. Lil Peep was originally from Long Island and moved. He was born Gustav
Orr.
That's yeah.
A-H-R with the funny circle above the A.
Yes. He had, I think his father was fodder.
Wow.
Wow.
He's Swedish. That's yeah. I was just speaking Swedish. His father was Swedish, who was largely absent from his life, but he moved from Long Island to LA when he was like 17 to pursue music. And went by the moniker Lil Peep. He is largely credited with a lot of the headlines that came out around him when he was still making music was like, is this the revival of emo? He's known for taking like alternative guitar riffs and mixing them with like trap beats and creating this like sort of genre of emo, or if not creating, like refining this genre of emo rap and, or as he called it, like alternative hip hop. And unfortunately, he passed away 2 years ago now? Last year.
It might have been this like year. A year ago.
Or it was a year
like
ago.
Now?
A year ago,
fall, right?
A year ago, like the day this podcast comes out, I think.
Really?
Oh my really?
Check that, wow. But I'm pretty sure.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure. It was definitely like mid-November of last year.
Okay.
I definitely remember that day because it was the first time I was exposed to him and you were sitting
Wait, yeah, it's tomorrow.
Room.
That's really tomorrow. Sad. It is gonna be, yeah.
Shout outs, Lil Peep and Lil Peep's family. Obviously,
R.I.P.
Yeah, you came in, Danielle.
I walked
and
in
me
and you were
like
super upset. You're like listening
I didn't
to the
sleep.
Song.
Like I was fucked up. It's wild because like Colin, you were the one who put me on to Lil Peep. Actually, by way of So you said that one of the things that made Peep that was like notable about Peep's music was a lot of samples of like acoustic guitar stuff, alternative and indie, like '90s and early 2000s independent music. And literally, the IM to me from you in November 7th, 2016.
So 2 years ago.
Was quote. This was also the first time you'd ever actually IM me on our internal IM thing. Have you heard the white rapper that samples the microphones yet? And I said, I have not. And you said, I am not sure that I recommend it per se, but I am fascinated. This is your guy. And you linked me to a review of White Wine.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, maybe fascinated isn't the right word either. This definitely exists. Let's go with that. And then I go, oh boy, I hate that I like this sample. I hate it. I'm a bad person. And you say, this is exactly where I'm at. Fuck. And then I go, I might put this on repeat. I feel like past me is very disappointed in me. And
recapping old IMs is like really horrifying.
Well, so the thing that happens is like over the course of the next few days, we transform from people who are like skeptical of Peep to people who are like, you're like going to see him live. You're like, I'm so excited to go see him live. I'm going to get to interview him. And you come back from that experience being converted in a sense, or at least convinced that this is not a gimmick and that this is not, that there is there. You know?
Yeah, for sure. So I got the assignment because I tweeted something to the same effect. Like, basically, like my like gut reaction to what he's doing is to hate it. Because I mean, he samples the microphones, but he also samples stuff like Pierce the Veil and Flyleaf, like stuff that I don't hold a lot of fondness for at this point in my life. No offense, Natalie, you're giving me a look.
No, it's funny because like that was extremely. Like, I've had two major phases of music, I would say. And the first one was, like emo, pop punk, like, very scene sort of, like, the music that he's, like, the lesser music that he's, like, sampling, like, that, like.
Sure, and that was his upbringing, too. Like, I mean, growing up on Long Island, that's, like, that was, like, the thing at that.
Oh, yeah. As someone who's in college on Long Island when he was growing up on Long Island, yes, like that was absolutely the scene there.
Yeah.
And that definitely comes through. And Long Island definitely comes through, not just in his music, but also in his like his style, the way he speaks, and especially in his music videos. I think that there is so much to be said about Peep's music, but as much as to be said about like what that dude did via the videos that he was in, often with other artists, but like so many of his early videos are just like him fucking around in Long Island,
right?
You know, with like a faux like handy cam style, like camcorder, you know, style to the aesthetic to the videos, and that all does feel so suburban and so like, you know, it's so small. Like I think when we think about like when I think about this album and I think about the expectations of this album and I think about what. If you go back and read some of the obituaries written about Peep or some of the pieces that happened after he died, there's an epic quality associated with him, a sort of like, but, you know, if not for this, he would have had the world at his fingertips and he was shifting everything.
A lot of them talk about like his endeavors into like fashion doing these like larger than life things, like creating this like Lil Peep brand.
Right. And I'm saying he wasn't working in those spaces, but I think that there's a risk of overshadowing the mundanity of much of his early music, especially.
Right. DIY, like not just like not as a, like a philosophy, but like just that's all there was. There was no ambition beyond that. Well, but I think that. Oh, go ahead, Rob.
Sorry, and the question I was going to ask is, does Come Over When You're Sober Part 2 play into that sort of posthumous narrativization of his life and what his arc would have been. I'm coming to this with no investment in this prior, but one of the things you mentioned in your article about the album, and certainly when I went back and I listened to some tracks that Natalie forwarded to me from his work previous to this.
Yeah, I should say that I had them listen to White Wine, Ben's Truck,
Beamer Boy,
and Save That Shit. Like context before totally. Come over when you're sober.
It was a council. Yeah. Natalie and I took a council.
Austin and I, we came with different things and we had to pick what we overlapped. Yeah.
But I was struck by how completely different the music from this last work sounds from previous work. And part of that is... So there was a lot written about, there was a long interview with his producer, Smokesack, Dylan Mullen, over at Complex, talking about how he finally had a chance. He had access to like more raw material than he'd ever had from Peep's work. And he's able to produce a much cleaner and epic sounding album. Like, I'm listening to this, it sounds really fucking good, but it also sounds like a very produced album. And I'm kind of wondering, is this final album, is Come Over When You're Sober Part 2, also kind of an effort to sketch out a what would have been character arc for Peep?
I think that it is in ways that are both cynical and not. Mm-hmm. Because
yeah.
I think he was already, I mentioned this in the piece, I think he was already on that arc. Mm. Like, if you listen to Come Over When You're Sober Part 1, it's just so much more of a pop record
100%
than anything that he'd done before, like Ben's Truck being an example of that. I think that it's just clean, and so much of his previous stuff was these like really gnarly like distorted samples and stuff like that,
often that had one verse maybe, right. And sometimes not even by him, right? Like, I think for me, so what's funny is I think we came into Peep as listeners, Colin, you and I, and I don't know when you came in, Natalie, but when he was in the middle of this incredibly creative period with contributors or with features, mm-hmm. Partially with other people like Horsehead, but also a lot with Lil Tracy, whose name now just Tracy. I think
it's hard to say. Check his Twitter. He changes his Twitter.
A lot of my favorite Peep songs are actually Peep and Tracy songs, either Tracy songs featuring Peep or mostly Peep songs featuring Tracy, in which Peep does the hook and Tracy does the verse. And then it'll often be like hook, verse, hook, out. 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Short songs. Like, here's the skeleton of a song that by the time you get to Come Over When You're Sober Part 1, those are 3.5-minute songs with two or three Peep verses on them. And like, they've been and have a lot of the rough edges have been sanded down, so you could imagine it hitting radio and doing really well.
And it felt like that record should.
That
have.
Record especially.
Like, Awful Things from that record is one of his, I think, just like flat out just best songs, whether it's like the most Peep song or not. Like, mm-hmm. it's this massive thing. There's video of Good Charlotte covering it.
Yeah, that was I watched that
at his memorial service. I think that a lot of people like reasonably expected that that's what was going to keep happening, mm-hmm. for him, that he was just going to write more epics. And I was re-listening to this New York Times podcast that was recorded right after his death. John Caramonica interviewed a few of Peep's close like media friends, essentially. Mm-hmm. And one of them was like, seeing the crowd gathered for his memorial was just like devastating, because that is the crowd that Peep deserved, but it should have been in a stadium LA park, like mourning him.
Yeah.
So in some ways that I think that this record does, it is like projecting that a little bit, but it's the headspace he was already in. All the vocals for this were recorded at the same time as Come Over When You're Sober Part 1.
Can you explain how this worked? Because this is so interesting to me because it goes against so many other musicians, and especially in like the hip hop space and even in the emo space, the way I understand song composition, or the way I default to thinking about song composition.
Right.
Can you explain like what that
was? So
you explained it to me the other day and it was just like, oh, what? Okay.
So what it sounds like from both the Complex story that Rob mentioned and there's a New York Times piece that also goes into the making of this record, it sounds like Peep was always like home recording just all the time.
Mm-hmm.
and because that's how he started. So he was working with either reference tracks or even just to a metronome or something, and, or like very bare bones demos and recording all of his vocals. And then his producers would come in and work after the fact and like build out the beat from there. So he had all these melodies and like stacked harmonies and stuff like that. And I think the thing that Rob was gesturing to was in the complex story, Smokestack mentions how it was the first time he had access to his separated out vocal stems, meaning like this, he would sing it over and over again, both to sing harmonies and also just to give it this huge sound. And in the past, it's from what it seems like in the article, this isn't like explored as much as I would like. He was giving those vocals as like just like one file. Like
right.
He was deciding the mix of like what it sounded like. Yeah. And now this time Smokestack was making that call, which I mean, it probably sounds like objectively better because of that, but there's no way of knowing if the decision to make it sound objectively better is what people would have decided.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
Yeah. I mean,
there's
like,
a moment where you, oh, sorry.
No, go for it.
I was going to say there's a moment where you describe I remember reading a lot of this stuff. He described like feeling like Peep was like there with him, like standing over his shoulder, kind of saying like, all right, that one or not that one. And then it that kind of obviously contradicts with like the idea of, OK, nobody can ever actually know that. Right. Like
right.
It's his interpretation of what Peep would have wanted. And that's never going to be like a perfect one to one.
Yeah.
Right?
And by all considerations, they were extremely close. Like that. Yeah. They were like more or less best friends. So if anyone is going to do this job, it's going to be him. But there's just like, there's no way to actually do it. That's the thing that I kept coming back to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it really is striking, like going from listening to that earlier work, which is all super compressed. It's kind of like almost wall of soundish. There's not a huge open soundstage that you're hearing. It's all very like in your face. And then
you can even just look at the waveforms on SoundCloud and see that.
Yeah. And then you listen to this last album and like everything is separated out beautifully. There's a huge like soundstage, like that was from left to right. It's a very producer's album. And like, this is where it gets interesting. Like, I have no doubt that the people involved were going about this with the absolute best of intentions. Like, it sounds like everyone involved in this album deeply cared about, admired, and loved Peep. Like, his mother was, like, a key figure in, like, putting this album together as well. And
they had a great relationship. Like, that was,
yeah,
like,
that was something I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Because that seemed to come through in the piece, in the complex piece, but, like,
yeah, like
I don't know him that well, you know, his music that well.
The first tattoo
he
got
it was when he was 14, and it's his mom's initials and her birthday, and he got that so that she couldn't be mad at him. But like in every interview you watch of like Lil Peep talking about like tour life or talking, just he always like talks about his mom and how much like he loves, and he like calls her every day and stuff. Aww. Like they were like very, very close. She gave him the nickname Peep because she would call him like a peep or something. Like a little, she would, and so that's like what was like, they were very close.
This amazing story he told me about. So he dropped out of high school and ended up finishing online.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he never really actually did any of his work, just his mom would do all of it for him.
Yeah, like his mom like wrote all the essays or something.
Yeah, that adds up.
He
was busy writing incredible emo hip hop music. You know?
Absolutely.
Apparently.
Absolutely.
So,
but wait, really quick, there's a specific thing here that I think Natalie called out that builds on what you just said, Rob, which is, or this whole conversation around, you know, what would have this album sounded like? It's impossible to know in some senses. But what you can track is a change in style, in direction. Mm-hmm. And I think the track that you pull out is Life is Beautiful, which previously had been released as just Life with a different beat. Mm-hmm. And there are such different songs. And I think the Life is Beautiful on the album is like such a pop, like perfect pop song, like that completely summarizes the direction he was headed in since Come Over When You're Sober Part 1.
Mm-hmm.
It's really listenable. It has like the the beat doesn't really get in the way. It is like a very framed song where you're able to like understand the lyrics and like work through exactly what he's saying.
Yeah. Original... But also like digest the lyrics in a way that's like a little bit easier, because
he's talking
I think
about brutality here. He's talking about true love here. He's talking about like it's super easy to like yeah to follow along.
Yeah, but I feel like that almost having that sort of like very clean, like beautiful melody, like backing those like very like hardcore and hard to listen to lyrics, like almost makes that a little bit easier to digest. Because I think like when you listen to some to the earlier stuff, like how grating everything is in like in for me, like the best of ways, like it can be hard. Like that's not going to be a hit, you know what I mean? Like if you're having like these like
yeah.
overwhelming lyrics and like overwhelming like sound, it's like
I will also say like that original Life beat is extremely like chill beats to study to.
Yeah, no, I just mean in like in terms of like his earlier stuff
totally,
in general.
Totally,
yeah.
I'm saying just for this one song, and for me the thing that's interesting is like I think part of me still likes that earlier version better
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways. Even though it is not like ready for the prime time in the way that the album release is.
Totally. I mean, I think it's just how I'm oriented as a listener. Like the like gnarlier stuff where you have to work for the spark,
mm-hmm.
like that is mm-hmm. always what I'm going to be drawn toward. But I mean, Peep wanted to be famous on some level.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, totally.
So I think, go for it.
I mean, I think that he like when you said what you just said about the sort of crowd for his memorial being like the crowd that he deserved. Like, I feel like this album is an attempt to achieve that crowd. Like, even if it is like through like radio listens or something like that, like it's unfortunate that the song with X is a song that's like has yeah. the most fucking listens.
You want to explain briefly why that or like
why that fucking sucks?
Or who X is?
Yeah, so Extension is another rapper who Lil Peep basically the story as I understand it
exactly.
The story as I understand it is Isle of Meconan wrote this song with Lil Peep. I'll explain who X is in a second, but Isle of Meconan, another rapper, wrote this song with Lil Peep falling or it was called something else.
The Sunlight version, on Your Skin.
Yeah, that's the version.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sunlight on Your Skin. And then after Lil Peep's death, X like reached out to Isle of Meconan and like asked to be like on the song, and that's how Falling Down came to be. And the reason why this fucking sucks is because basically after Falling Down got released, because it was like one of the first songs that was released from this like upcoming album. It's not on the actual bass album. It's like on the bonus version, which is like the first one you have on Spotify
right.
anyway.
In 2018, it's on the album.
Yeah, like, right? Like
major labels are going to major label for sure.
Yeah, 100%. And Extension was killed last year, but only after having spent a lot of time both growing in stature also by making sad hip-hop music, by making songs often dealing with things like mental health and personal anguish, and also being like a raging homophobe, an abuser, like a violent abuser to a partner of his, and just generally an asshole in ways that Peep had spoken out against in a more general sense.
Right. Right, which showed in like the reception of like people that were close to Peep to the song being released. I know that a lot of Goth Boy Click, which I think most of these tweets have since been deleted, but like when the first sort of when the song first came out, a lot of members of Goth Boy Click were like, Peep never would have wanted this. Like
he like literally went out of his way to remove.
So, yeah.
Like, it's 2018, which means Spotify playlists are an important thing. And so like Peep went out of his way to remove X from Spotify playlists that were like, if you like Little Peep, listen to blank. And
yeah.
Like, get that shit out of there. Here is money. Get it out of there.
Yeah.
So
like Peep, as someone who was like openly bisexual, and like, you know, such like a positive person when it came to like encouraging like people to identify the way that they wanted to identify, and in like terms of like the way that he felt about like his image, like he always like had like it just it's so incongruous to like who Lil Peep was to have like this be the number one. It like feels it's like infuriating to.
And also it's the result of two grieving mothers talking to each other. And like that ends up complicating it in this other way.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably one of the most complicating things about the whole final like, Come Over When You're Sober Part 2, which is like a lot of these songs are about death. A lot of these songs are about drug use. A lot of these songs are about many of the factors that would eventually contribute to Peep's death in a way that are, and I don't mean that in a, they're not glorifying of that stuff.
Yeah.
But they are... There, it can be hard to listen to someone say, like, oh, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
For sure. I'm definitely going to die. I want to die in some ways. I'm in a self-destructive place knowing how that story turns out.
Yeah.
You know?
But there's one lyric, I can't remember which song, but he talks about waking up surprised that he was alive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was trying to die last night. Like, that's just so brutal to hear in, like, I think that his career was built around lyrics like that. Like, that's something that has always drawn me to his music, that he represented almost like a stubbornness to continue to like push past all the shit.
But something I was curious about when I was listening to some of the stuff is that like a couple things that jumped out at me when I was listening to, well, in White Wine, it's coming out of Lil Tracy's mouth, but it's also coming out of Peeps in Beamer Boy, which are these kind of notes of like, I don't know, it's almost sardonic or maybe even a little bit resentful that like there's this public performance of like pain and rawness that like in a couple of these passages feels very much like this is an act that Peep can't that people will not let Peep quit. Like in Beamer Boy, you know, there's the they don't want to hear that, they want that real shit, they want that drug talk, that I can't feel shit. That is like that is extremely like the frustration of the public persona being something you can't put down when it doesn't feel right. Like that's,
which is so funny in the context of Beamer Boy, because that was like one of his first huge songs. Like he was maybe already a little bit sick of it then is kind of funny.
I mean, it seems like a thing that is easy to get sick of when, I mean, if you trace it through the music, what you see is a lot of that is a reaction. A lot of it is a reaction to just like things that are common for a lot of people, like general depression and feelings of isolation and alienation and not knowing who you are because you're a young person and like an experimentation. And like there's plenty of space for these things in anyone's life. But a lot of it did also come from this place of like, I don't know where I fit in the world. I don't know what I'm doing. Like I'm struggling to figure out who I am. And by the time you make Beamer Boy, you know, he had found success to some degree, you know, in like the online space and had figured out like, oh, I like making music a lot. I'm working with people who I like to work with. And so like, I'm not saying that those things are a remedy for depression or for drug abuse or anything like that. But to some degree, like part of the cause had been addressed through him finding this amazing creative outlet. And so I can imagine immediately being like, oh, fuck, but they still want that real shit. Like, I can totally respond to that. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah, it probably gets a little old having to talk about your suicidal ideation 100 times, right? You know, like in every tour you go on, like you have to talk about this thing that is like came from a very real, very raw place. Mm-hmm. But also now you have to talk about it all the time. You have to put that out there all the time.
This is, you know, Tracy is right. I can't fuck with you if we weren't friends on MySpace.
Yeah.
You know?
Aww. But I...
also, but when I think... go to castle, won't let no one inside. Like, oh man, does that resonate? Sorry, I cut you off. I just had to. I love that line so much.
No, it's so good.
It's really good.
Tracy's so interesting. Did you know that his dad is Ishmael Butler from Diggable Planets?
From Diggable Planets
and Shabazz Palaces.
Yes, like so. Tracy comes up through this musical heritage, runs away from home, starts making hip hop music, starts making rap music, meets up with Lil Peep, and I think the two of them have this just like. I like, there are YouTube collections where there's like every Lil Peep X Lil Tracy song. Please just go listen to their entire oeuvre together because the two of them bring out the best in each other. And I think Tracy's still going to have an incredible career going forward.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see a dip for the next like 2 years and he's going to release something that's really incredible.
Well, have you heard Like a Farmer that came out this?
I did hear Like a Farmer. I did hear.
What was that reaction?
You know.
You should check it out is all I'll say.
Yeah, you should check it out. Well, like it's very funny because It's a very funny song. Sorry. No, because he also just did a track with Riff Raff, who is in lots of legal trouble right now for fucking fuck off Riff Raff right now. But yeah, Tracy is an interesting figure, and I think that this entire sound has been such an interesting thing. This entire, like, specifically at that point, goth boy click, but in general, the kind of like emo rap movement is such an interesting thing because of the crossover it's allowing for Black artists. And so one of the things I hope that doesn't get lost inside of talking about Peep and Peep's death is that there are lots of great Black artists in this space also. And obviously a lot of them have crossed over at this point.
I mean, Juice WRLD.
Yeah.
Doing like basically
Juice WRLD Future is like a crossover I didn't think could happen
right
5 years or 2 years ago. You know what I mean? Not 5 years ago. I don't know who the fuck Juice WRLD was
It is really hard to think about though. I think that so Juice WRLD is another rapper in kind of working in a very similar sound who had a top 10 hit this year. Like, part of me is like, good for Juice WRLD, like, good for him being on a mixtape with Future, but it's like, oh man, that really should have been Peep, you know? Like, Peep was growing up listening to Future too. Like, that should have.
I also like Peep way more than Juice WRLD, so.
Tom Bryan at Stereo Gum, like longtime rap critic at many different places, said that Juice WRLD is the Macklemore to Peep's atmosphere.
Yeah, okay. Wow. It's a very poor.
Yeah, people who love Minnesota-based hip-hop will get that one. Anyway.
All right. I guess, what, like, real quick before we wrap up, just any favorite albums off, any favorite tracks off Come Over When You're Sober Part 2? Just as we close out here, what's your essential track off this album?
I mean, I think look at a track list.
I think for me, it's probably Life is Beautiful, just because it. I mean, if we're to assume that this project is kind of like the vision for what Peep would have been, that song is it. You know, like that's the stadium anthem that he's playing for the encore. I think.
Yeah,
you know?
I can see that. I really like Sex With My Ex.
That's me.
A lot. It's just so one, it's the thing that feels like the most old Peep.
Yeah.
By far. Two, the hook is just deeply infectious. Sex With My Ex is like the most corny, simple line, but he delivers it. He feels it. He really does. And he makes me feel it. He really does. I also have a least favorite song. I'm going to say that. And that is Hate Me. Which comes right after Life is Beautiful. It feels like someone went, this is a diss. This is too, it sounds like you went on YouTube and searched DJ Khaled type beat. and it is like, I think lyrically it's fine, but I think like as a song, it's a lot of grasping for what is the next big step in this, in this artist's sound.
Sure.
And it could go in that direction or it could go in the Life is Beautiful direction. Life is Beautiful is just much stronger.
Yeah. Danielle, do you have a favorite?
I came to Peep very late, like during this, and also I was exposed a tiny, tiny bit on the day of his death by Austin in this room, feeling sad, and I felt it too. I think I am now sort of a fan. I'm like a fledgling fan because I was just sitting at my desk listening to a bunch of this music, like almost crying, just feeling like, wow, this is amazing and good, and how did I not know about this, and holy shit. I probably like default to Life is Beautiful just because, again, I'm so new to this and that does feel like what this is or what this is going to be or what this is sort of like was working towards that evolution of. But I want to revisit Peep. I definitely want to revisit Peep in a future waypoint because I feel like now I will go down this rabbit hole. This is a very, this is just like Elliott Smith kind of situation where I only found out about this artist really after their death, and that makes me very sad, and that's a shitty thing, I think. So,
like Elliott Smith, there will be an entire generation of people inspired by Little Peep,
probably.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that sad reality is that it's also going to be, it's going to be more specifically people inspired by X, unfortunately.
You're probably right. That's sad. That's sad.
Oh, man.
What's your favorite track on this?
Mine is Runaway. Because that's when I messaged you and was like, Austin, something's happening.
It didn't happen.
Something happened. I'm really sad and fucked up over Lil Peep right now. And it happened on the second song of the album. Runaway is my favorite. And then Life is Beautiful, I guess, is the one that sticks in my head the most. Sex with My Ex is also so fucking good. So
I love the sheer unabashed 211 of Sex with My Ex, by the way. Like, just lyrically, musically, just the, like, you know, let's leave it all on the field.
Let's put it all out there. Yeah. Yeah.
100%. I do want to shout out to the other bonus track that's not the X one, is the other version of that song that he wrote with McConan. And I think that that song is incredible.
Song had come out in June or in May, we would have heard it a million times.
I think that's the best of the whole record, even though it's not properly like part of the track list. It's just like so...
Got those hand claps.
Tender and just like the best of both of what they did. Mm-hmm. And for what it's worth, they were collaborating a ton at the time of Peep's death. By all considerations, they had a very intimate friendship and really understood each other. And Peep, like, super admired McConan as a songwriter. I think that they both work very, like, gut level, get a song out in 5 minutes sort of thing. So they just were – they recorded a ton of material that's still yet to come out. So this isn't
Suspect you'll see some Conan Peep stuff.
Yeah.
When, like, in the interviews, like, just before Little Peep passed, he talks about, like, an album with McConan coming out. Like, it seems like there is just a lot of material that they were putting together.
And they just seem to be so happy to be working together at that point, too, which is just, man.
My last, like, favorite thing about, not favorite thing, this isn't right. The last thing that I think about a lot is... regarding a lot of this is when White Wine hit, one of the things that people did immediately was put that song and some other songs that other Peep songs that had sampled Microphones and Mount Erie in front of Phil Elverum, who is the Microphones. And at first, Phil's response had been this like really Phil response of being like, get this shit out of my face.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you mean this kid that stole my songs?
Yeah, exactly. And then Peep died, obviously. And then Phil loses his wife and writes what I think is maybe one of the best records I've heard in this phase of my life.
Two of,
yeah. Acro Looked at Me and Now Only, both incredible records. Did you listen to the live? People should listen to the live version.
I still haven't done
it. People should listen to the live version of both, but go listen to both A Crow Looked at Me and Now Only by Mount Erie, I guess the name on the tin, right? Phil has, you know, Little Peep died, and then I think a combination of those deaths forced this person who is this like consummate alternative independent musician who is making music not for the mainstream to reconsider where young people are and what music can do. And there is something in the way seeing that much talent lost should affect us. And I think Phil is someone as a musician who captures the loss of life really well. And it is weirdly important to me that he fucking walked that back. Do you know what I mean? Like that, like there was this moment of recognition of just like, fuck, like people dying sucks, and it doesn't matter if you're like people dying no matter what sucks, but there is something that brings that into focus when it's about someone who is so young and so has so much ability to touch other people and share something powerful. And I'm just happy that one of my favorite musicians walked back some bullshit about another one of my favorite musicians, and I will leave on that.
All right, we will take a break here before we dig into our other waypoint for this week. Quick note, this is actually a mega waypoint recording, so that's why we went really long on one segment. We've actually sort of, we had a too big show. Now we have content for Thanksgiving week. So you're welcome, listeners.
Internet.
Yeah. And we also gave ourselves just a complete green light to really obsess over our favorites this week.
Yep.
Anyway.
That's what we did.
We're going to take a quick break. You're probably going to hear an ad. Maybe not. Who can say? And then we'll be back with some more music discussion.
Thank you. When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So, the other waypoint for this week is PJ Harvey's Let England Shake, which is an album from 2011, and it's also kind of my way of trying to get at some of the things that I've been sort of chewing over for the past week as a lot of countries around the world have been observing the centennial of Armistice Day, which marks the end of World War I in 1918. And, like, I thought of a lot of different things I could try to sort of put in front of y'all, but, like, this seemed like a good all-encompassing way to talk about, like, the Great War and the way it's remembered and the way it's been observed, as well as sort of the political moment in which these observances have arrived. But I felt that Let England Shake is a really good point of entry to that, because I've been listening to the album a little more lately, and one of the things that's really struck me is not just that it's a really powerful album about World War One and sort of it trades a lot in the imagery that we associate with the war, but also it's a very, what's the way to put this? It is a very post-British Empire album in a lot of ways. It's a very ex-Empire album. But it's sort of written in this interesting context of the entire album is conceived and written in a political moment when the Empire is sort of long dead. And yet the album positions itself and its narrators as people sort of speaking from almost the height of the Empire or the moments when it's just starting to come apart. And that sort of got bound up in my head with just the way these things are being remembered and observed. Sort of this is an album also about sort of the self-deceptions and illusions.
Oh, yeah.
That countries tell about themselves, particularly Britain told about itself.
Goddamn Europeans, take me back to beautiful England starts the second song on this album, and then paints a beautiful image of England, you know, from the gray to the gold of it, you know?
Yeah.
And there is, in that depiction, a sort of nationalism. And for me, it was hard to separate out PJ Harvey playing characters in this space from PJ Harvey, the songmaker who was writing songs about England, you know?
And important to note that she's English, right?
Yeah.
In all of this. Which I...
And also this album came out like 7 years ago or something. This isn't an album
pre-Brexit.
Pre-Brexit.
Which is also
Brexit,
important
fair,
here. Yeah.
But well past, you know, this wasn't in the middle of the 70s or something,
right,
where England was still being very, I'm not going to talk about what England's colonial policies are now. I'm not smart enough. I don't know enough about them, what their current situation is.
Well, but the album is definitely being written in reaction to the complete demolishing of the public reputations of anyone who's involved in the Iraq and Afghanistan efforts.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure.
And so the interesting thing is, when this album came out, you'll read a lot of reviews that were sort of contemporary with its release, reading it very much as, well, it's an album about World War One, but really it's also about Afghanistan and Iraq. And there's some fairness in that. Like, you can't separate the modern geopolitical landscape from World War One. It just cannot be done. Particularly with regard to the Middle East. But also, I think that does tend to maybe give a little bit short shrift to the way this is specifically about, you know, the First World War and the things that that Britons told themselves about it, both at the time and in popular memory of the war. So, yeah, I'm just curious, if you all had a chance to listen to it and what you sort of made of it.
It's something that I remember listening to when it came out, and I haven't revisited it a ton since then because I think the it just was so wasn't what I was used to from PJ Harvey. Like that's
interesting.
She hadn't traditionally been a political songwriter until that moment. There's this like interview from the NME that got from the early 90s that got quoted a ton when this record came out, where she was like, I haven't been political in my music, but I'm gonna have to change that soon. And it still took her another 20 years to do that. But yeah, I mean, I love her as like kind of stoner mystic romantic songwriter, and that's the context in which I was like familiar with her when this record came out. So the idea of like an intense dissection of war was just so like out of my idea of what PJ Harvey could be that
see that's funny because I didn't know PJ Harvey very well at all. Like this album was kind of my point of entry to her work. So I go back and I listen to her earlier work, and it's informed by Let England Shake. And so I look at White Chalk, for instance, and I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, I can draw that line really easily.
Sure.
But then, like, there's a track that you sort of passed to us when we were talking the other day about you coming on the show. And I listened to that, and I'm like, okay, that's a completely different act. That's just a completely different musical act.
There's the song Reeling she released a collection of 4-track demos, and it's like my favorite thing of hers as like the abstract songwriter. It's like the opening lines are like, I want to bathe in milk, eat grapes, Robert De Niro sit on my face. That's like about as far from Let England Shake as you can get, I think.
Yeah.
There's, you know, that's about colonial politics.
Sure.
Yeah, you know?
In a way.
There are certainly a lot of evocative imagery involved.
Yes.
I guess I'll say this is that, like, for me, the thing that felt so this isn't a take, this is a description of the text, this isn't subtext, but like so much of this felt like reading the poetry written about that war mm-hmm. by people in the war, in terms of the laborious careful descriptions of physicality of smoke and ground and like the earth itself and things dripping and things, you know, tanks rolling across fields. And there's a description of that stuff that is not fetishizing it in any way, but is in fact like the terror of it all, but mixed in with the sort of sensual description of nature that marks so much of the poetry that came out of World War I. That's kind of what I knew I was getting into, but I didn't expect to be impressed by it, and I was. I think that like there are a lot of tracks here that where her lyrics are very specific and bring you to a specific place and time, which to me does contribute to the feeling that this is, as Rob said, like an album about World War I specifically and not just generally. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are you know, there are truths about war. In a general sense, there are ways to have a political feeling about war in a general sense. But the First World War, its causes, the way it was fought, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, their causes and how they were fought are distinct in specific ways. And I am personally glad that though those things, the moments when she is being very specific, do tend to feel specific to World War I. Otherwise, I think I would actually really despise this record, because it would wash the hands of so many misdeeds in our more recent wars. You know,
yeah, creating some sort of like universality to like war.
We're all fighting.
Like,
you know,
yeah.
We're all bad animals. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think that one of the things that struck me on revisiting, though, that I think does link it to her past songwriting, is that this record is like deceptively really funny, which is something that is true through all of her music. Like, no matter what she's doing, there's just these like sly moments, like the I want to take my problem to the United Nation, calling back to Summertime Blues.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I just think that's such like a clever thing, and then I'm sure that you'll want to talk about this in a more pointed way, Rob, but the video you linked of the performance on the British late night show, where it starts with the sample of Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Right.
And she's just like, she's really funny, and she finds a way to make like really heavy shit. Like, it's I think that this record can be viewed as like a dark comedy in a way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a thread that runs through a lot of World War One memoirs and a lot of the poetry. Again, that's a lot of the poets she's channeling. There are poets who sort of trade in the imagery of, and like a lot of times it's the same poet doing both, right? Like there's there are poems that are describing the horrors of trench life, but then there are also poems that are really about just like these little vignettes into the war. I'm trying to find. Okay, yeah. So I'm glad I linked this. So Siegfried Sassoon's The General is a good example, because basically it's just this brief image of one of those like very bluff, hail and well met type general officers, popular with the troops, just giving everyone a good pep talk as they march off to the lines. And, it ends with one of the soldiers in the poem saying, "He's a cheery old card," grunted Harry to Jack as they slogged up to Arras with rifle and pack. "But he did for them both by his plan of attack." And like it's this pitch black aside, right? These two soldiers being led to the slaughter, and they kind of like the charming fellow who sort of architected this entire shit show. And I think that's something that the album's playing with well.
Yeah, it's so, I think it speaks to kind of like, when I first listened to this album, I just thought it was like folk music, but the kind of songs that you sing when you're in the war. Do you know what I mean? Like the songs that you sing like with your troops, or the songs that you sing like, you know, in waiting or whatever, where they're composed of like moments and like descriptions and scenes and stuff like that are just like super expanded, and like moments that are like made legend almost, was like my sort of reading of this.
Yeah, a thing I couldn't quite get out of my head, and I think this is one of the things I really love about this album, is it sounds like it is informed by the type of music soldiers going off to that war would have listened to. Like, it does have sort of, it like, the music does sort of harken back to traditional tunes, folk tunes, country ballads, stuff like that. But also, it's got this very, like, bitter, rock-inflected modern edge, which I think sort of taps into, like, the rage some of these, like, some of the war poets start to articulate toward the end of their experience. But there was no musical culture that could really articulate that, or you know what I mean, or put it into any kind of like raw, unfiltered form. And I think Let England Shake starts to do that a little bit, like right, like what would Wilfred Owen's punk band have sounded like? Possibly a little bit like this. And I think that's one of the cool things about this album. I think the other thing that I've sort of been turning over with this album, and it speaks to that sort of debut of Let England Shake on that late night show where she does this. It's a really darkly comic moment, right? You've got Gordon Brown there sort of presiding over the growing wreckage of New Labour and the fallout from the Iraq War. And she opens with this song. And not just not just as it appears on the track, but it is over that, you know, not Istanbul, Constantinople song. What's the original of that? What is that sample?
Is it That Might Be Giants? Is it a
no?
They do a famous cover of it. Okay. I'm not sure who the original composer is. Something that stuck out to me is that it's also a deliberately out of key sample that she uses. Mm-hmm. She starts playing the song on an auto harp, I think, and it just totally clashes with the sample and just keeps the sample riding throughout the whole track. Mm-hmm. So it's just like this like comedy chaos, like really just like really dark and weird.
And Gordon
like,
Brown's right like, there.
Yeah.
yep.
Yeah. And
good.
And so I think the other aspect of this I find fascinating is that so World War One, and I think this is one reason why the centennial hasn't been particularly it hasn't had anywhere near the cultural impact that like World War II's 50th anniversary has had, right? And part of that is the veterans are gone. World War II, they were still, when the 50th anniversary rolled around, they were still among us. But I think there's also a very real aspect of World War I does not serve a lot of people's agendas to memorialize or think about. Because for a lot of the powers involved, it's a complete catastrophe, right? Like the war's enduring images aren't redemptive. They're sort of images of mass slaughter. And so it's interesting to me to consider like, how is this war being recalled and what messages are people trying to draw from it, at the time of this observance? Like I was really struck last week by, God, just all the people you'd expect giving massive props to this ridiculous Macron speech about how nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism. And it's just this, it's this eye rolling, like attempt to draw a distinction between like nationalist extremism, and good patriotism, which he doesn't really articulate because the line, it's not, there isn't a line, there's a continuum. and it's a lot more complicated than that, but it's this attempt to, instrumentalize these memories. And in a lot of cases, it's the people sort of charged with these observances are also people who are representing this like steadily weakening neoliberal world order. And I think one of the things that I think about, with this conflict, and then it sort of comes up in the album with the, what if I take my problems to the United Nations line, is there's this tendency to view the war as a tragedy of there not being strong enough international institutions. And there's a case to be made there, but there's also a tendency for the people making those arguments to also being like interventionists when it comes to foreign policy. You know what I mean? Like they tend to be very like pro humanitarian intervention. They tend to be very pro, you know, things like NATO and such. And so that's the other thing I tend to hear when I listen to this album is a deep skepticism, that these institutions are necessarily going to actually help or solve any of the problems that the speakers of this album like are experiencing.
Yeah.
Right? That the people who suffer from these policies are kind of left on their own. And the people in charge chart their own course. That's one of the things I hear when I listen to this.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, Rob, as someone who has studied and thought about World War I, I suspect more than certainly many of us, and likely many more than many people, you know, in terms of pure percentages, for many reasons, for many of the reasons you just described, what should the takeaway be for us in 2018 when thinking about the centennial of Armistice Day? And maybe should is too strong. I don't want there to be an obligation. I guess more of what is yours and what is a productive way of framing that conflict in an era when most conflicts that occur are not similar. Most armed violent conflicts between nations are not similar in nature, both in cause and in execution, and in what the arms look like, frankly, and what warfare looks like now. And also in a world that in which that sort of symmetrical warfare between like countries has been reduced to nil, and the bulk of armed hasn't been reduced to nil, but for us speaking in the West, countries like ours are rarely fighting against other countries armed the way ours are, and warfare has become a much more asymmetrical thing, that maybe has pockets of like-to-like warfare, like-to-white, like skirmishes with small arms or whatever, but a world in which, you know, the arms race was won by certain nations, and then we put in place a political scheme to make sure that those – that the very highest end of arm is only available to us. How do we think about a war like the First World War, the Great War, now, a century in? Small ask, yeah. I know.
Simple question.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things I – Like, one of the reasons I think I find this war so fascinating is because it's a war where everybody basically gets it profoundly wrong. And people blunder into it to a large extent, and then they really have no idea what to do with it once it started. I mean, one of the things I bear in mind is that there was a similar sort of complacency, I think, in the world leading into World War I. Like, you'd had the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, but, like, for the most part, like, nations, there hadn't been a full-scale war between great powers involving mass mobilization since, like, Napoleon, really. Like, this was, again, I think you could easily find people in, like, 1910 or so saying, like, well, you know, those days are gone. You know, obviously most wars now are frontier wars, colonial wars. They're deeply asymmetrical. And so I think there are some parallels between that world and our own, that political moment and our own. I think there's also something I return to a lot is one of the other reasons this war tends to be regarded as a tragedy, like, for instance, Niall Ferguson sort of popularized this view shortly before. That's back when he wrote history as opposed to try to, you know, conduct vendettas against his grad students. But he sort of had this view that the tragedy of World War I is that it's the West turning on itself, that it's the West being distracted from its, like, civilizing mission and its great success. It's sort of basically dominating the globe in the late 1800s and the 1900s. And I think it's also worth bearing in mind, and I think that the album even sort of refers to this a little bit when it samples Blood and Fire, which is a reggae song by 90. And it's the hook, the one of the recurring lines there is let it burn, let it burn. And I think a thing worth bearing in mind here is that a lot of the major combatants tend to regard the war as a tragedy because they suffered unimaginable losses, but also many of them came out unimaginably weakened. And for a lot of other people, World War I also accelerates decolonization. You know, it begins to put cracks in a lot of imperial facades. Mm-hmm. And that's another element worth considering here as well. We tend to view it as this shattered the bonds of internationalism and brotherhood that was starting to crop up across the West, across Europe. It also shattered a lot of the engines that sustained really brutal colonial regimes and started to accelerate their decline. So that's the other thing to bear in mind is that a lot of the speakers in Let England Shake, I think, tend to have this very green and pleasant land view of England without any reference.
They sure do.
Yeah, without any reference to the global empire that lifestyle is built on.
Yeah. That was like for me one of the big tensions. And it's one of my big tensions whenever I go back to it's one of my big tensions whenever I go back to anything from centuries and centuries of time produced by the West, because so much of it turns a blind eye to what built those spaces and those fortunes. I mean, we're going to talk about The Ballad of Black Tom next week in the next Waypoint episode, which I think tries in some way to confront the history of Western violence.
Look at The Hobbit. Like, look at Bilbo. Like, the Shire is England, and it's all just these little goodies and snacks. Oh, the hobbits! They just love to have their little jams, their little teas, their little cakes, all their little comforts, and
their second breakfast.
Yeah, 11Zs, all that. And throughout it, there's this the image it's portraying is of an entire like way of life where every little like daily luxury and indulgence was probably in some way inflected by imperialism. And in the magical world of Middle Earth and you know, Tolkien's can be problematic, but he's also a smart guy, but even in this conception he's still like, Yeah, but the Shire really is isolated. Like, the like they really can, they're really not connected to the world around them. And it's only a moral argument that connects it to connects them to it. It's a feeling that these things will reach you too someday. Not that actually there's a lot of things we take for granted that depend on the state of the world.
Well, and like I think so for me, this is like one of my favorite topics to think about is how did the people of in the moment of modernization begin to think about the past, begin to create the other and think about their present day and whether or not it was lost already. For me, there's this moment in England at the turn of the century in, you know, the early 1900s when media scholarship first began. You know, for a long time, scholarship, you didn't study popular music. You didn't study popular culture of any kind because it was low. And to study something meant to study greatness. And greatness was associated with the classics, was associated with Latin and with, you know, the Greek tragedy and with the great histories. And you know, maybe you were allowed to study the, you know, other distant foreign cultures, but only because they were other and distant and foreign and you could frame them as such and take something from them. But, you know, with the rise of what we think of as mass culture through technological means, we end up having these people who suddenly go looking for a past that wasn't there. For me, like the two that I go back to the most are there were a pair of I guess I would call them academics, the Leavises, L-E-A-V-I-S, who do all of this writing about how terrible mass culture is, that it's an imitation of true culture, that it is you know, distorting the public and corrupting the youth and all this fast music and candy.
I've met these people, I think.
Yeah, probably, right? Yeah, right, because every generation has these people.
Yeah.
And what they pointed back to was this very Hobbit-like past of England. Oh, what we need is a return to the old pop culture, to folk culture, when we all gathered at night and we had a little guitar and we played songs together and we sang about how great the country was and how beautiful the green was and we all had, well, you know, maybe we should go back to having a shared garden, but maybe that's about as far as we shouldn't get rid of the aristocracy. In fact, maybe we could have a little bit more aristocracy. Things were a little bit better then. And those people were inventing something that never existed, right? That like folk culture in that Hobbit sense never existed. And I think maybe Tolkien is actually more honest about it than many real conservatives and reactionaries have been, which is at least in Tolkien's Hobbiton, people are cruel to each other and are bickering and are backstabbing and are constantly in this very human, right? But for me, like that question, how are you imagining your place in the world and how are you imagining the past that brought you here is one of the most important ones that we can contend with as cultural critics. And it's one that's so easy to fuck up because especially as you get older, there are moments. It's one of the reasons why when you send me someone like Little Peep, my first reaction is not fuck off. It's fuck off, this is kind of dope.
Yeah.
because like there is I think we always have to contend with our place in the present and with the ways in which we mythologize the past, because that's always towards something. There's always like an end goal there, whether or not it's a conscious one. And so for me, like this is like as someone who listens to hip hop with Little Peep, it's like I need to be careful not to become the old head who is like, no, rap music is about XYZ thing. Even though at the same time, I want to be conscious of like appropriation and about who gets paid for the labor of many people before that. And it's when I listen to an album like Let England Shake, I really like it. But there are moments when it slips into when I lose the sense that there is a moment of remove there where the descriptions of England become so almost lurid in their beauty that I feel like I'm being peddled something that I can never actually get behind because it would never – one, because it never existed, and two, because it would never have been mine.
It's – I think that relevant to this is that PJ Harvey's next album was 5 years later, the Hope 6 Demolition Project is I think the name of it. Are you guys familiar with that?
No, I'm not familiar with that at all. Please.
So I've heard it referred to by people as Let America Shake. She like did some traveling to Afghanistan and I think Kosovo and then to DC, and it had some missteps, to say the least.
Oh, really?
She took a lot of heat from some activists in D.C. for the way that she portrayed D.C. specifically. Like, there's this one song, I can't remember, but it got a ton of press. If you just, like, Google anything about this record, she, like, refers to, like, a place in D.C. as like, a drug town and uses the phrase, like, zombies, referring to, like, the homeless population and stuff like that. Right. And it's, like, for all that she gets right on Let England Shake, just, like, not having the perspective to and knowledge to do the same thing here.
Well, there's, and I think this is it's weird, we're going to talk about this later today, but you're going to hear it in a week. It is easy when you're talking about places to fall into stereotyping, even if you know them well, even if you grew up there and lived there. This is what we're talking about with Laval's Ballad of Black Tom. He gives an interview where he talks about in one of his earlier works, he had friends from his old neighborhood reach out to him years later and were like, you know, it's a good book, but wasn't as bad as you make out, man. Like, you know, like, we also just lived there.
We had happy times.
Yeah, we were okay. Yeah. And I think that's easy to slip into even when you know a place really, really well. Definitely easier and more problematic to do when you're a, white artist from England parachuting into different parts of the world being like, I need to shake people from their complacency and paint the most dire fucking portrait of your lives.
So I think what she ultimately ended up saying was that she was trying to quote a Washington Post reporter who had given her a tour of DC, but still it's like,
in the listening, that maybe doesn't come through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that there's still stuff of value on that record, but they're just like, the things that you're talking about, like, starting to see in Let England Shake just become a lot more transparent the next record.
It's fascinating. Like, I have, like, such a minimal PJ Harvey history. Like, I've heard a couple of tracks here and there, but I'd never dug into the discography, and this is the first time that I did that in any way. So I appreciate the addition to the bank of knowledge.
Her 90s records are, like, absolutely essential.
I'm gonna dig back.
Dry and Rid of Me are, like, all-time greats.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
Gotta do some PJ backlogging, for sure.
And that will do it for... Where the hell's... Oh, Patrick, get out of the document. God damn it. I'm trying to get to my outro, and it just keeps dropping down further down the document because Patrick's in there,
Patrick's
like,
adding notes editing, for the next
which
episode.
Which is good. Good for Patrick. But at the same time, Patrick, not now. Anyway, that'll do it for this week's Waypoints. Our thanks to Too Mellow for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at twomellowmakes.bandcamp.com, and you can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney, and you can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Colin, where can people find you and keep up with your work?
I'm on Twitter at outasightouta and noisy.com.
That's how many T's are in your outa? Are you two T's?
Two T's.
Two T's.
Like there's a Wilco song.
Gotcha.
I made my Twitter when I was really into Wilco in high school, like freshman year of high school.
Perfect.
Aww.
We all do things in the world.
Do you disavow Wilco now, or do you just disavow being that into Wilco?
I think I disavow being into anything enough to make it my handle on on the internet. I wish I'd just used my name. Had I known I was going to be a professional anything, I probably would have done something different.
Oh. It's also S-I-T-E, S-I-G-H-T.
Yeah, sorry. It's confusing. I regret it every time.
I want people to be able to follow your work because you do great work. People should go read your piece on Little Peep over at noisy.com.
Yep, noisy.com.
Y'all have .com.
Yeah, so we locked up. We locked down. You can also go to noisy.vice.com, but...
No, fuck that. I'm trying to go to noisy.com. That's all I'll say about that.
Yeah.
All right.
Danielle, where can people find you?
You can find me at Danielle RI on Twitter.
Austin.
Austin _ Walker on Twitter.
And Natalie.
At Natalie Watson on Twitter.
All right. Well, we hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back again with Waypoint Radio later this week. We might also have a movie podcast hitting up this week. I've lost track a little bit of...
Which purge is this? Is this election day?
No, four.
Election year.
This will be election year.
Yeah, next week we'll also have Purge,
the first Purge, which is the fourth Purge
the fourth
movie.
Purge movie.
Stick around for that one. If you find yourself getting demoralized by election year, I would say, like, yeah. stick around for the first purge.
The first purge.
Yes.
Yeah. If you
but
were
listen
like,
to both of our podcasts.
Yeah, definitely no matter what. Listen to both, for sure. You can watch Election Year. You should, and then listen to us talk about it, because we have thoughts. But then really listen to the first, or watch the first purge.
Yeah.
And
you should watch them all. Sorry.
You should.
Yeah.
Watch them all. We've been doing rewatch. We've been doing a rewatch, which has been really fun. So, awesome.
All right.
Oh, and then, I mean, next week we can say what our next week waypoints are for once.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So people can be really prepared. Yeah.
So next week, we are going to be looking at the latest season of Channel Zero, The Dream Door. And we're also going to be sort of, I think, probably putting a period on our era of Lovecraft reconsideration by reading The Ballad of Black Tom by Victor Laval. Which I just finished and thought was pretty fantastic and a really interesting alternate view of Lovecraft stereotypes and tropes.
If you really want to go deep, you can also force yourself to read The Horror at Red Hook, or at least read there's a tour.com like we read it so you didn't have to style post called where'd it go? Here it is. It's The Horror at Red Hook, Lovecraft's Most Bigoted Story, No Really. And it's written, it's a piece written by a couple of people who add some commentary to why it is that. And Laval's work is explicitly a rewrite of that short story. And that short story is available for free. Like all of Lovecraft's stuff, you never have to pay anybody for it. It's all on Lovecraft.com. Lovecraft.whatever is my new website.
Lovecraft.Cthulhu.
Yeah, they got that one. They locked that one up. We thought about Waypoint.Cthulhu, but we thought better of it. So
yeah.
So yeah, that's next
even
week.
Cthulhu gets redeemed a little bit at the end of Black Tom.
Spoilers.
Whoa.
All right. Well, we hope you'll join us again for that. But until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.